from Hollywood, it's rated LGBT Radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
And good evening, good evening, good evening. You are listening to Rated LGBT Radio. I am your host, Rob Watson. And tonight we have, as usual, an exciting and intriguing show. One thing that I think has plagued a lot of aspects of, quote unquote, the LGBTQ community is knowing our history. And a lot of the things that have been talked about, the historical LGBTQ movement, has been through the venue of the media and the public television platform, et cetera. And so some stories have gotten out there, but it hasn't had the real fluidity of a lot of the things that have happened in the past. And tonight we are going to talk to a very talented man named Brad Dunshy, who created something called the Mattachine Podcast. And Brad will tell us why and how he was inspired to do this. But basically, he has set out to create a weekly podcast that gives us a glimpse into different aspects of LGBTQ history. And probably a lot of the things that he's done and is going to do are parts of the history that you may not be that familiar with, which makes it a very, very good thing. Joining us tonight also on our panel with our expert journalists are Brody Levesque, if I can speak, Brody Levesque and Don Ennis. And it's usually Don's name that I mess up, not usually Brody's. But with that, we will go to the newsroom and Brody and get some of the latest stories of the day. Good evening, Brody.
Good evening, Rob. Good evening, folks. Headline news for Thursday, February 8, 2018. Stocks plunged again today, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average diving more than 1,000 points for the second time this week, despite attempts by the Federal Reserve and Treasury Department officials to calm nervous investors. The volatile market of the last few days also continued to plague the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ indexes. Both were also down significantly. The Associated Press is reporting that the government of the United States may shut down again tonight at midnight as Kentucky Republican Senator Rand Paul holds up votes on the budget deal, claiming that both Republicans and Democrats are, quote, spending us into oblivion. Lawmakers on the Hill had pushed to enact a massive budget deal along with a stopgap temporary measure to prevent a shutdown, but hopes for a mid-afternoon vote were dashed by Paul, who was holding the measure up for now in hopes of winning a vote to reverse its spending increases. The White House is now telling agencies to prepare for a shutdown, according to Reuters. In Tampa, U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions, in a speech touting the Trump administration's efforts to combat drug abuse and trafficking, drew jeers for suggesting that people in pain should consider over-the-counter aspirin instead of opiates. Quoting the Attorney General, "I am operating on the assumption that this country prescribes too many opiates," Sessions said. "People need to take some aspirin sometimes." CBS News is reporting that in a sign of increasing partisan hostilities, Republicans on the House Intelligence Committee plan to construct a wall, a physical partition separating Republican and Democratic staff members in the committee's secure meeting and office spaces, according to multiple committee sources. In Washington, Defense Secretary James Mattis said that Dreamers serving in the military will not be deported, even if the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program expires. Quoting the Defense Secretary, Mattis told reporters, "We would always stand by one of our people." The feud between Vice President Mike Pence and gay U.S. Olympic men's figure skater Adam Rippon escalated again Thursday when Pence tweeted directly at the athlete, describing Pence's history of supporting ex-gay conversion therapy as fake news. A check on Pence's congressional campaign website from a few years ago, however, clearly shows support for conversion therapy under the category Strengthening the American Family. The Los Angeles Blade is reporting that an Ohio trans boy is seeking a judge's okay to avoid conversion therapy. Ohio Superior Court Judge Sylvia Herndon will soon decide whether a 17-year-old Cincinnati high school senior can live as a transgender male or must undergo Christian-based psychological conversion therapy treatments. These are aimed at preventing his transition. Court documents show that his parents asked the judge to prevent the teenager from undergoing hormone replacement therapy, even though he now lives with his grandparents. The grandparents fully support his desire to transition and are also seeking full custody of him. Finally, another trans woman has thrown her hat into the political ring. Andy Mara, a Korean-American, has announced that she will be running for a New York State Senate seat to tackle the affordability crisis affecting New Yorkers from all walks of life, among other issues. That's the news for today, and Rob, back to you.
Thank you so much, Brody. And tonight I want to say hello very quickly to Don Ennis, our other member of the panel. Good evening, Don. How are you doing?
Hi, guys.
Glad to have you on board. And without further ado, I do want to bring on our guest for the evening. Brad, welcome to the show. And we're glad to have you.
Thank you.
So, Brad, I want to start off. Tell us your inspiration for the creation of the Mattachine podcast.
Sure. So I moved to San Francisco from the Pacific Northwest about 5 years ago and very quickly had about a year-long stint in the Tenderloin District. Are you familiar with it?
I definitely am.
I
maybe
am.
For people out of the area. if you could describe
what
that is.
It's a colorful area, for sure. So it's one at the time, we were at the height of the market, and San Francisco rent is pretty much out of control. So we made the decision to save properly for a wedding and moved into the Tenderloin for a year into a studio apartment. And so I lived down the block from Constance Cafeteria and was walking by one day and saw a plaque on the wall commemorating it. So I kind of did some digging into it, knowing that Tenderloin was kind of one of the epicenters of gay life in the city. So did some investigation and found out that three full years before Stonewall happened, there was a transgender-based riot that occurred there, and it was one of the first uprisings in the gay community. So I was floored by the fact that I didn't even know that. And that was the germ of the idea.
Excellent. Don, you had some questions?
Well, I want to know, have you heard of this guy, Dylan Jones? So Dylan wrote an op-ed in the British website Attitude, and the headline made me so angry. Young queer people shouldn't be obliged to care about LGBT history, and that's the biggest sign of success there is. I went off on Twitter about this, and I'll be very honest. I usually don't get involved in Twitter wars, but I just had to come out and say, this is dumb. This is dumb. This is dumb and dangerous. And this is exactly what's happening in our country in terms of rolling back our entire movement in terms of, you know, where we've been. If anything, this gives lip service to the fact that there are still trans people who are struggling. And whatever twink bubble this person is living in London, good for them. But the rest of the world, we're dying, and we're not able to convince young people, thanks to this person, that it's important they know where we've been.
Yeah, I fully agree. Just, 2 weeks ago, the National Coalition of Anti-Violence Programs released their study. They did a look back basically on 2017, and the murder rate in the LGBTQ community is up 86% from the previous year. A lot of that was Pulse, the tragedy that happened there, but unacceptable. So yes, we can very easily backslide into previous times that weren't so great for the community.
Brody, you had a question?
Yeah, and good evening to you, sir. It's good to talk to you again in full transparency. I'm the person responsible for Brad being on the show tonight because I called him up and I said, hey, I read the piece in The Advocate, and I'd like to talk to you about that. So good evening, Brad. Welcome
good evening.
To my corner of the universe with Rob and Don. We have a lot of fun, and Karen, too. Let's talk a little bit about the machinations of what you want to do in terms of the project, because as you and I talked about previously, there's a lot of different aspects to coverage of the story, and the story being about the tribe in general. How do you intend to frame the conversation as you go forward?
So tactically speaking, what I'm doing is on a weekly basis, I'm trying to find stories that people may not know about. My effort is to reach, we talked a little bit about this on the phone. My effort is when I sit down to record the podcast, the first thing on my mind is I'm talking to that 17-year-old kid who's closeted, who lives in Nebraska, who doesn't have the support system that he needs. The delivery mechanism of a podcast for me was super important in that people can put earbuds in, they can listen to the content and not worry about any people, you know, overhearing that process if they are in a closeted situation. So the idea behind the content is over time to have listeners actually submit stories that I may not be aware of. That was kind of the concept behind it. I'm already starting to get story ideas. The Advocate article helped quite a bit in fomenting a lot of those, a lot of that input. So yeah, that's kind of what I'm doing. And I'm basically going out with the podcast, just factually speaking about the actual story itself without any kind of agenda behind it. I just really want to report on what the facts were.
Okay, fair enough. Let me do a quick logical follow-up to this, and I'll throw it back to Don and Rob. Delivery. You're going to do the podcast. You're going to put it together, edit it, package it, et cetera, et cetera. Where does it go? Does it go to iTunes? Is there going to be a website or Facebook page? In other words, how do we make these things available so that that hypothetical 17-year-old sitting out in Lincoln, Nebraska, or Fort
yeah.
Kearney, Nebraska, can, you know, actually listen in?
Yeah, so what I do to promote, so first of all, it's important to know that I've worked about 20 years in digital media, primarily doing large-scale web builds for Fortune 500 companies. And so, and what I've done with my career over the course of the years is identify what's new or nascent on the horizon within digital, become educated in that space very quickly, and then serve those solutions back to my clients. So when podcasting really kind of hit the scene, for me, it was an opportunity to get messaging out there, like I said, in some cases in a private fashion. But I've been hyper-attuned to the power of media for close to two decades now. So what I'm doing on a weekly basis is I'm basically utilizing social media, pushing stories out that way. I have a subscription on my blog that I announce when I have stories that have been released on a weekly basis. Basically just using all of the tools available to me that I've known from a digital media perspective over the years.
Brad,
sounds fair, Rob.
On the subject, thanks, Brody. Brad, the stories that you pick, how do you go about your research to create kind of a unique voice and a unique perspective on the different subjects?
So what I do when I sit down and decide to develop a story is I first and foremost hit the web. I basically just look at articles that are written there. And then I go through the process of, it's also important to note that I have a degree in journalism from the University of Oregon. So the way I approach the storytelling is done from my classic training in journalism. I basically just go out, do a lot of research, try to get two or three fact checks in, and then I actually sit down and compose the story.
Terrific. Don, you've got some questions.
Well, first of all, hats off to you because I love the fact that you're a journalism veteran, because I think there's a lot of people in No, it's true. There's a lot of people in this space that you're operating in who have no classical training in journalism, and I've worked for editors who were not journalists who just think that, you know, it's just whatever people are talking about. And I appreciate that in this modern age, anybody can be a journalist. I agree with that. But there are certain standards that by following them, we achieve and promise our listeners, our readers, a level of confidence that they won't get from someone who's just repeating gossip. You know what I mean? I'd like to ask you two questions. The first question would be, you referred to your work in the corporate world. I'd like to get your perspective on how you've seen it evolve and if it's evolving fast enough. And the second would be, what podcasts are you listening to? What's on your iPhone or what's on your iPod that gets you going?
Yeah, that's a great question. So because I work in an office environment in downtown San Francisco and 95% of what I do is done through email, I listen to podcasts 24/7. My earbuds are always in. I'm always listening to content. What really captured my attention early on in terms of the power of the voice is Joe Rogan. Are you familiar with his podcast?
Yes, I am.
I'm not. Yeah.
It's pretty great. And he's kind of left of center when it comes to his political views. So I appreciate that factor. So I listen to his stuff quite a bit. A lot of the NPR type content I listen to. True crime is another huge, huge area for me to explore. What's it called? My Favorite Murder is a really funny one. Two female comedians who sit down and they tell each other stories basically on the murder that they researched for the previous week. And hard to imagine, but it's actually quite funny. So.
No, I love that. I think also I'm sorry, Rob. It fits into that voyeur mentality of we all like to hear about stuff. And it's just those kind of podcasts are really popular right now.
Yeah. But what I don't like, I've found out recently just through trial and error, is the overly produced stories. I like the from the heart, this is how I feel about an issue type of approach to the content development.
Brody? I was going to say, yeah, I can honestly 1,000% agree with that. Let's talk about content. Let's talk about stories. Obviously, Brad, there are seminal events going over the timeline in the modern LGBTQI history, and in terms of just more than activism, but in terms of personal stories. In our telephone conversation, I mentioned to you Nathan Mansky and the I'm From Driftwood Project. I also mentioned to you Charles Chan Massey, who runs the Personal Stories Project in Los Angeles. Both Nate and Charlie do a very good job of capturing, I think, the essence of that. So let's talk about what you want to capture. When you say unknown, and of course, you know, you're one of us in terms of journalism, we can go through the timeline and we can hit the optics and the metrics of Matthew Shepard, Stonewall, you know, the Black Cat in Los Angeles, the founding of the Advocate, the founding of the Washington Blade, blah, blah, blah. So what makes the difference here? What is it that you're aiming for? And what is going to make it an integral part of someone's experience by listening to you so that it doesn't become, quite frankly, and I say this in fairness because, you know, today's millennials, you know, bless all of them, they have the attention span of a flea. So you know, what's going to capture that, Fred? Go ahead.
So I actually don't want to be the judge of that, meaning I don't want to be approaching the content development from an editorial standpoint by making decisions about what is worthy of storytelling. I want the community to tell me. I want them to submit story ideas. And if it sounds interesting, I'll pursue it. That's my bottom line is it's an opportunity to deliver interesting stories that may appeal to the community that people may not know about. That's it, basically. So I don't have I have a general idea of stories that I want to tell, like the AIDS crisis. That's going to be a huge one. I can easily see a 10-episode arc on that one. Some of the some of the more kind of prescient within the last, I'd say, probably 30 to 40 years stories that are typical. I also want to touch on those as well. So.
Okay, well, that makes perfect sense. So it's going to be, are you envisioning this? And, of course, this is going to date me immediately, but as kind of a gay on the road with Charles Perrault, you know, kind of doing a Sunday morning.
Yeah, that's a good analogy, actually. That's a really good analogy.
Okay. Well, with that, I'm going to throw it to Rob.
Okay. I wanted to kind of go into similar vein, Brad, because you're the podcasts that you have are kind of eclectic. I mean, you have from Montgomery Cliff to Layla Alcorn to the Compton Riot. You know, it's a very interesting mix. Were those all requests from individuals
actually,
too?
No.
What
after
was your inspiration?
Doing research out there. The other thing that I do on a daily basis, I subscribe to RSS feeds that I've curated over the years that are stories specific to the gay community. And on a daily basis, I go through and I look at literally hundreds of headlines in terms of what might be an interesting story. And so what I've done with my social media accounts is I have it set up automatically where if I actually push one of those feeds or that story to a specific keyword basically within the RSS feeder, then it gets published automatically from my social media account. So if it captures my attention and I think it's interesting, I want to serve that up as a little kind of nugget of content that might be interesting to the community in general. That's kind of the other piece of what I'm doing on a daily basis. But all the stories that are currently up there right now, those came from stuff that interested me as I was navigating the content. The only outlier is Leela Alcorn. That actually came from one of the community reached out basically and said, hey, you need to look at this. This is an interesting story, and it's something that I think we should tell. So I was very happy about that. And then, like I said,
yeah,
because of the
good
article in The Advocate, it's gotten a lot more publicity, so I'm getting a lot more story submission ideas.
Great. I'm going to turn it to Don. Don?
Well, God bless The Advocate. I think that if I look back on the last couple of years, for most of the people I know in our community, Pulse was the 9/11. Pulse was that time where there was a before what happened to Pulse and there was after what happened to Pulse. And I was wondering how your view of Pulse evolved, because one of the things I did was I was woken up by my editor at The Advocate to start putting videos online in the middle of the night. And it was an amazing, incredible, and scary experience. Even though I was 1,000 miles away in Connecticut, I was basically, you know, living what this terrible ordeal was and trying to find information that I could put out reliably on the website. And I can tell you that for folks who live down in Central Florida, it's still very raw. And having been to the club in the aftermath, I can honestly say it's a moving and scary experience to this day. What's your take on the history, the storytelling, how Pulse may have changed our community?
Yeah, so that is why I'm doing what I'm doing, literally. Pulse wasn't the catalyst in terms of me getting motivated to develop the content, but you know, I'm coming into my 40s now and seeing that this is still happening in our community, it's just absolutely unacceptable. And the reason it continues to happen is because people normalize violent behavior. And if you look at the trans community, for example, and the murders that consistently happen and targeting of people of color, it's got to stop. And one of the ways that I think I can contribute to getting something like that to stop is to put those messages forth. Like I said before, I have an understanding of the power of media. If you look at the Trump campaign before the election, everything was crooked Hillary, crooked Hillary. There's a reason why that repetition existed in his language. So one way to kind of combat that type of violence and that level of hate is to put out positive messages to have our community understand that they should be proud of who they are. We should understand what our triumphs have been. We should understand what our challenges have been. And I firmly believe that it's that old saying, if you don't understand your history, you're doomed to repeat it. So that's kind of, that's my thinking around Pulse. I can't believe that we live in this world where that continues to happen.
Thank you, Brent.
I don't know. I think the thing that also, going back to your statement about those that don't are doomed to repeat, in many ways, I see a kind of a gulf in understanding between the older part of the generations of the LGBTQI community and the younger ones. Now, you and I talked about this on the phone. The younger ones have the freedom of expression that the older generation, mine in particular, didn't have. You know, we weren't able to, you know, walk down the street and hold hands and this, that, and the other thing. We'd get arrested, you know. So it was one of those things where I think part of this is about context. Talk to us a little bit about what your feeling is as you're doing this to get that context in play there and make it accessible and understanding so the metrics and optics of what you're doing in these podcasts not only honor the previous generations before, but also help to educate, you know, things going forward for the younger generations.
Yeah. So that's a tricky one for me in that the way I like to approach the content is to tell it very factually. I've caught myself a couple of times editorializing within the content or sharing elements that may be of relevance to the story based on how I was how I was brought up. That's a tricky one for me. I do want to keep the content to be kind of not unemotional because there's great emotion in it, actually. Matthew Shepard, that was an incredibly hard one to get through, specifically because I was almost his age when that happened. So it's I try to keep as much emotion and editorializing out of it as possible. I really want to serve the content well and tell factually kind of what the genesis of the story is. I try to limit that as much as possible.
Well, my logical follow-up to that is that there are certain stories, though, where would it not be better to have a little bit more of that type of not editorializing, but the color and the feel and the fabric of that emotional. I mean, let's face it, as journalists, one of the things that we do is, you know, we tell stories that need to be told. And, you know, there's sometimes with our reporting, there's no way to avoid that. Certain stories, you know, you think would probably be better suited for that or no?
There are, yeah. I can tell you, going back to the Matthew Shepard example, reading his father's letter that was read in court, the victim's impact statement, that was incredibly emotional for me. And when you listen to that content specifically, you can hear in my voice that I was clearly upset when I was recording it. I didn't really see a way around that. So for me, it's whether or not I connect emotionally. And if I do connect emotionally with the content, then 9 times out of 10, the content tends to get better traction when I publish it. And I think that just comes down to people want to hear authentic stories. They want to hear that you have, you know, a dog in the fight. So,
there are
elements that, like, I'm dreading, to be clear, navigating the content of the AIDS crisis. I grew up in that era and was pretty much at puberty when that really started becoming a thing in our community. So had to navigate those waters very carefully as a young man. And how I'm going to connect with that content, and also knowing that I have friends here who are probably 10 to 15 years older than I am, who tell me that they lived in San Francisco during the AIDS crisis, and they literally would be going to funerals every week. So I don't think that the younger generation understands that, or the impact that scourge had on our community. So that's another reason why we need to get those stories out there.
I would agree. I would absolutely agree. Rob?
Yeah, I can relate to that a lot. Brad, I really love what you're doing so much. And I have two 15-year-old sons, neither of which are, I think they're both going to be pretty straight. I mean, that's their indication to me. But do you have any vision of, I know they had to come out to me as straight. It was a very hard talk. But anyway. Oh, well. A lot of things that are going on in their schools, especially in California, now that there's been legislation to expand the history coverage to include LGBTQ history. Do you have any thoughts in targeting kind of the broader heteronormative audience to these pieces of history? Where is your artist audience target ultimately?
Yeah, that's a great question. When I record the content, what I'm thinking in the back of my mind is we're a tight community. We're a very widely striated community. There are many differences within our community, but we're still kind of one cohesive unit. And so that's what I'm thinking about when I develop the content. I'm not thinking, how do we get content out there for the straight community? This is my personal opinion, but I'll be frank. I grew up and watched media like any other normal kid. And, you know, the straight community, they've been telling their stories for eons. And, you know, if there's an opportunity to kind of carve out a little niche for our community, that's kind of my thought behind that, and focus on that target audience and not trying to normalize all of the content, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that totally does. Don?
Sorry, had you on mute. I have a 15-year-old daughter who's lesbian. I have a 19-year-old son who's bi, and like you, Rob, I have a straight son who, because he found out on National Coming Out Day that his siblings are LGBT, well, I want to be gay. I'm wondering, how do I help them see LGBT history as something that's just not the old boring history? How do I help them understand our history? And what can we do to reach our millennial audience, the ones that Brody said have a attention span of a flea, meaning they just tuned out because I talked too long?
Right. I think the vision that I have is like the content that I'm producing developed as a whole. Like if you go to my homepage right now, you can see the sheer amount of episodes that I've released. Taken as a whole,
address?
I think, it's www.mattachinepodcast.com. And so when I look at that content, the vision also in the back of my mind is like, can parents potentially use this as a primer for having discussions with their children about, I guess my vision is if they can sit down with the content, put that in front of their kids and use it as an opportunity to open a dialogue with their children about the community, that would be the ultimate, I think, goal or the best use case that I can imagine for the podcast.
Brody? Cool.
Yeah, no, the thing that I think, and for all you millennials living out there, don't send me hate mail. one of my kids is a millennial, so, and most of my very young and talented friends are also millennials, so that was a sideways crack not to insult all of you. But I think that Don's point is really there, and that's actually my point and has been as well, is accessibility to the history to make them understand that. You know, you talked about the impact of the Shepherd case, and one of the young people that I'm very dear friends with is director of communications for the Matthew Shepherd Foundation. And in the 6 degrees of the LGBTQI community, she and her partner, both girls, are from Central Florida, and she lost her best friend in the nightclub at Pulse that night. And she set up, it hit her hard. Now, she set up with his friends a Drew project. And one of the things that they wanted to do was to capture the sense of the history and the feeling and the vibe for, you know, young people so that they understand, you know, where we've been is not necessarily where we're going to be headed. But we do have to understand where we've been in order to get the context of where we're headed. You know, you talked about the effects of Dennis's letter that he read to the court. I was sitting in the courtroom.
Oh, wow.
I can tell you about the impact. So I know exactly what you're talking about. And the essence of that, and this goes, and I'm basically following up with Don's line of questioning here. How are you going to capture that, and how are you going to make it the imperative? Because I think in a lot of ways that's what history is. I'm a historian, so I always look at it from a standpoint of an imperative. So, Brad, take it away.
Yeah. So again, the way I like to approach the content is to tell it from a very authentic place. Like I have a genuine interest in these stories, and I have a genuine interest in making sure that they don't get forgotten. And so it's not like there's not a time when I sit down and I think, oh, this is a drag. I don't want to pursue this angle or pursue this story. It actually is super important to me because, there are elements within the storytelling that I have not been aware of. I consider myself to be a fairly educated person, certainly have the ability and the skills to go out and find information out there, and had always considered myself relatively educated about the LGBTQ community. So when I stumble across something that catches my attention and I had no idea that it was even a factor in our community, that to me is a flashpoint. I want to tell that story all day long. So that's typically how I think it might have much more impact out there in the market, is if you're speaking from a sense of authenticness in the storytelling.
Okay, I agree with
and
that.
And the other piece that is super important to me is to speak with it with passion and don't be afraid to back from that. There are elements in the stories that capture my attention that are tragic, and the way I tell that, I hope, comes across as from the heart, because I have a genuine interest in it. So,
fair enough. Thank you.
Brad, when you're, and I guess this is, I'm triggering this one particularly to the AIDS crisis, which I think you're in the process of writing about. I know you've put out a couple already. One of my observations of a lot of the accounts of the AIDS crisis is that they get very geo-specific. I mean, there are a lot of the histories written about the AIDS crisis get centered in New York, and it's all the New York AIDS experience. And the one you just mentioned, you know, a lot of people around San Francisco, which, in their experience, I actually lived through the LA experience of it. And they really actually each played out differently, even though, you know, there are obviously a lot of things that were going on at the same time and at the same intensity, but a lot of the histories were actually different. And because a lot of the, if you will, drama was happening kind of at a local level, the impacts were very specific to that area. Are you trying to pull all that together, or are you just staying with one of those kind of narratives when you approach one of these stories?
Yeah, great question. So the vision I have for that topic specifically is when I was very young, I read And the Band Played On by Randy Shills. And the way he approached that storytelling to me, even before having gotten my degree in journalism, struck me as a very unemotional, this is what happened, this is how it affected the world, not just what's happening in LA or New York. I think those stories are out there, and I think somebody's telling those stories very well. When I think about developing a multi-arc series like the AIDS crisis, literally in the back of my mind, I'm thinking I could tell that story on a macro level over 8, 9, 10 episodes. So that's my vision for it, is to tell as much of a thorough story as I can and try to keep out of the local. And I also say this from a political standpoint, that there's a lot of passion in each of those markets. And there's a lot of pride in having lived through a lot of that, age. And I don't want to kind of monkey with any of the politics, if that makes sense. I want to kind of keep out of it and tell the facts.
Yeah. No, that makes total sense. Don, you're up.
Tonight I was at a conference of journalists talking about covering racism. And, you know, a gay man and I attended this together with his lesbian sister and her girlfriend. And although it wasn't about LGBT, there's a lot to look at in terms of our history in how it compares to how Americans have dealt with racism. I was wondering how your work is intersectional and how you might be able to address that, because that's really very important, especially to millennials today, that it's not just the one label. We all have different intersections in our existence, and I was wondering what you think about that.
So the way I'm approaching that question is the sheer amount of episodes that I want to put out and the variance in that content is important to me. I want to accurately reflect what our community really is about. And I think that, like I said before, too many trans people are being killed and nobody's paying attention to that. 9 times out of 10, they're typically people of color. No one pays any attention to that. And that has got to stop in our community. And so the way I'm kind of serving that element is trying to not just stick within my lane or what my experience has been as a gay man who's white and in his 40s, but to look outside of my experience and look for the stories that would resonate across our community and not just through my purview, if that makes sense.
No, I want to follow up just by saying, as a white woman myself, I often have to check myself because, you know, I realize I'm not here to speak as just another white woman. I'm here to raise up the voices of the marginalized. And although as a trans woman, I am among the marginalized, there's nothing that compares my experience to that of a trans woman of color. And the same goes for any person of color. So again, I just think that, you know, our challenge is, you said before, you sometimes feel like you mix in your opinion, and it's hard because we want to put a statement out there, but it's more important that we find the voices that haven't been given a microphone or given an audience and raise those up.
Yeah, totally agree. 100%. Absolutely.
Brody?
Super important.
What are the let's talk about difficulties for a second. What are some of the difficulties that you encounter in making a decision? Well, you're laughing. Go ahead. I'll let you roll.
So I'm a professional who works in San Francisco in digital media. So time is always, you know, a factor in getting the episodes out on a timely manner. Luckily, I'm relatively disciplined in terms of how I approach the production each week. Happy on that front. But it really isn't, like, I don't have a lot of, like I said before on the phone when we originally spoke, this is very much a passion project for me. It affords me the ability to reach the masses, to tell unique stories. I have a huge love and interest in storytelling in general. And I also think that there's power behind the media. So sitting down every week to record that and put that out in the market is, quite frankly, a privilege. So I don't really view it as something that's difficult.
Well, I have a quick follow-up to that. Okay. Our mutual colleague, Neil Broberman, found you from The Advocate. Now you've got Don and me. And of course, this show with Rob. So now you've hit the national media market with the Pink Stream three or four separate times here. So what's your next aim in elevating the visibility of what you're trying to do? I mean, The Advocate's a good start. Don, myself, and Rob, that's another really good start. But where else can you go with this? And particularly since, and I'm going to be perfectly transparent, a lot of the millennials are glued to their phones, and the news delivery for them, quite frankly, isn't The Advocate or even what Don and I do. It's in other venues. So how are you going to get to them?
I'm going to serve the content well. I'm going to tell my stories authentically. And if I stick with that mission, I feel that over time, and I don't have a gun to my head in terms of how successful this thing needs to be. What I'm finding is that people are finding the material, they're connecting with it. I'm getting impassioned emails sent to me about some of the content that I'm putting out there. I can't tell you what that means to me. You know, when you sit down and you record something, you're sitting in your apartment and you've got headphones on and you know, you finish the recording, you go off to the grocery store and you carry on with your day. To know that those stories are reaching people and that they're having an emotional effect on these people, that's huge to me. I've already been successful, if that makes sense. What I'm finding also with the publications is that they're fomenting a lot more interest. Of course, more eyeballs matter, but just the little kind of drops that I've been able to get in terms of promotion, I'm finding that that is kind of an exponential thing. There's a lot more interest than there used to be, if that makes sense.
Okay, absolutely. I'll throw it to Rob with that.
So, Brad, I've got a little off-the-wall question for you. What are some of the subjects that have been proposed to you that you've gone, no thanks?
You know, I had a tough time. I was thinking about just media in general and the nature of podcasts. When I sat down and started going down the Tom of Finland route, I had a moment's hesitancy. I was like, God, is that content that I want to put out? It's maybe a little bit salacious or can be seen as salacious. I personally don't feel it is. But at the end of the day, it's still a part of our community. It's still something that people have a huge interest in, hearing his story. And so there was very little hesitancy behind it. I don't have any kind of content story ideas that are in the back of my mind where I'm thinking I'll never be able to tell that story. I'm kind of fearless in terms of what I choose to pursue. I don't really have a sense of,
right.
You know, yeah.
Well, I love the Tom of Finland one, actually. That was, I thought that was great. So I'm glad you did pursue that one. I guess what I was asking was, have there been ones that other people have requested that you have just gone, no, don't even want to, I don't want to do that
one? No. There really hasn't, actually.
That's kind of exciting just in itself. That's great.
Yeah.
John's got some
questions for
you.
You know, if somebody takes the time to sit down and tap out an email about, you know, wanting to showcase a certain story idea or whatever, that to me says that they're already emotionally connected with the material. So, I've not received anything where I'm like, no, I probably won't tell that story. If it's interesting, I'll pursue it for sure.
Well, that's
mentioned
cool.
Earlier.
I've got a suggestion for you that I'll make in a few minutes. Don, go ahead.
You sure, Robin? Yeah, you're teasing me. I want to hear what the suggestion is.
Well, then you'll have to make your question brief. No, go ahead.
I shall.
I'll work it in before the end of the show.
It's as brief as can be. You mentioned success earlier. How do you measure success? Is this earning you money? Is this costing you money? How much does it cost? I'm sorry. I'm a journalist. I have to ask.
So it's not producing any income. I think when I sat down originally and wanted to pursue it, I could think about, like, how do we – because this is what I do for work, basically. How do you monetize media streams? So I, of course, went there when I started conceptualizing the podcast. Could I – potentially be able to open up a revenue stream with it or whatever. Where I'm at now with it is I want to look back over the course of 4, 5, 6 years. I want to look at the sheer amount of volume in the content that I have out there. And that to me will be success. And like I said before, what a metric of success for me is when people reach out and they share that the story really meant something to them. Thank you for developing it. I genuinely take that to heart. So I'm not really interested in, you know, anything other than getting the content out there so that people can digest it if they choose to.
Brody?
Well, let's talk about, you know, content for just a split second. At some point, have you done your nuts and bolts planning in case you get overwhelmed? Because I know that there does come that threshold point where suddenly you find yourself inundated. It's like starting off with only, you know, 10 to 15 followers, you know, on Twitter, and before you know it, you suddenly have 1 million overnight. I mean, what have you done? Because you are working well within those platforms. What have you done in terms of preparing yourself for what very likely will be an onslaught, particularly now that, you know, the Advocate and then us, we've just now elevated your visibility considerably. So what planning do you have for that?
Great question. I haven't put any planning into that. That, frankly, would be a problem that I would love to have. I'd love to see this thing take off. I can think about potentially how to change workflows in terms of how I record the content, but I'm kind of a machine when it comes to workflows in general. Like, I just have processes set up that are repeatable and scalable. So hopefully that'll kind of serve me well as I navigate the next couple of years.
Okay, well, with those buzzwords, I will flip it over to Rob, since that's the language he speaks more than Don or I. Rob?
Actually, okay, so here's the one I would want to pitch to you. I would love, based on the kind of material you're working on, especially the ones where you're going into things that have happened in the past that people don't know that much about that are actually pretty impactful. The one that I have that in the back of my mind that I really am fascinated by and don't know enough about is the Upstairs Lounge attack in New Orleans.
Yes.
Which,
yes,
you know,
I know exactly
that,
what you're talking about.
I would love to see you do that one. Or hear you do that one.
I will
to be more accurate.
I will commit here and now to that, definitely. That's something that has caught my attention. I don't know enough about it to speak eloquently on it now. But I do know that there was some sort of tinge of police cover-up that happened with that. And in some cases, the family, I think I read, the families didn't even claim some of the bodies, knowing that it was a gay bar situation. And that, to me,
that is true.
Oh, that is super tragic.
Yeah. And I think those are the elements why that's one story that I'd love to see in your hands, because of those elements. Plus, I mean, the Pulse attack was horrific and terrible. In the end of the day, the motivation behind it was, I mean, not that it needed to be specifically out to get the LGBTQ community, because that's how it played out. But seemed, you know, sort of like, you know, that he was looking for a type of venue that it fit. Whereas the Upstairs Lounge was very specific. I mean, it was not equivocal in terms of what was intended and all the ways that they played out because of the time that you just mentioned make it even not, and I'm not trying to do a comparison, but it made it hugely, hugely tragic. And I just feel like there are people's stories there that deserve to be told.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's my
I'm in agreement 100%. The other piece, too, is like thinking about that story and when that happened and why that happened and why families made the decision not to claim their loved ones. That's back to your question about context. That was a function of the times back then. And that was part of the norm, was distancing yourself from any kind of you know, any kind of conceptualization of being a gay man or a gay woman or whatever. So providing that in the content, in terms of context of the time, I think is also super important. Just making sure that people understood that aside from the actual factual happenings that happened, but they should have a larger understanding of what was going on in the zeitgeist back then.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think in your AIDS stories, that's pertinent as well, because that was so much of the factor of the Reagan years which is an ironic juxtaposition given so much of the rhetoric now about, you know, from the Republican point of view about the Reagan glory days, and from
right.
the AIDS and LGBTQ perspective, it was anything but glory days.
Right.
So yeah, perspective is everything. Don, you got a question? Don?
I'm here. I'm here. I just had to keep unmuting. I'm sorry. I'm trying to be good. My last question, I only have a minute, so let's make it real quick. What would you recommend? What's your advice for young people who want to follow in your footsteps? And let's just be honest, there are lots of podcasts out there, and someone may
yeah.
get inspired just listening to your idea. What's your advice?
Go out and build your own thing. That's my advice. The best advice, I've connected with this process and this storytelling in such a way that, like, not to be, you know, woo-woo about it, but it feeds my soul. I work in a corporate environment all day, every day, and being able to work on something that I have a personal passion for, putting that content out, there's a whole process mechanically that goes into that production that I'm proud of. I taught myself how to do this. And having those stories thrown out there into the ether and getting positive feedback from people and shows like this, that kind of attention tells me that I've tapped into something, I'm on the right track, and that's the advice I would share with people that are wanting to pursue their own path with digital media production. Just go out there and build it. Teach yourself.
Thank you, Brad. Great advice.
All right, the last thing, and we're getting down to the final minutes here, and before I throw it to Rob, Brad, how do we find you? So you gave us the website, but do we have Facebook? Do we have Twitter? What do we have?
Yep, I've got a Facebook account. Mattachine Podcast is the page. I've got a Twitter account, which is Mattachine Pod. Those are the two kind of vehicles that I'm using right now. And then, like I said, I'm updating the site with content as it becomes available. And I've got response mechanisms on the site, too, so that's probably the best way to find me.
Sounds good. All right.
And let me also say,
Brad,
sorry, just using
– Go ahead. No, go ahead.
I'm sorry. One last thing. Just speaking kind of to the community out there, I really want to hear from you. So if you've got ideas in the back of your head that you want to be told, or you stumbled across an area of content that means the world to you that you didn't know before, share those with me. Please contact me. I would love to tell those stories.
Well, Brad, first of all, I've got one more final question before I ask it. I want to ask you to say, I am so thrilled you came on with us tonight. I think what you're doing is vitally important, not only to our community, but to the community at large. And as a gay dad, I really am thanking you for doing what you're doing. My final question, though, is what is coming up? What do you have that you are penciling out for the upcoming podcast that you're excited about?
That's a great question. I've had a little bit of a pause. I have a third episode coming for Don't Ask, Don't Tell. That was a kind of a huge area for me to jump into. And one that I lived through as well and was paying attention to the news when it was happening. So I'm going to finish out that story. I do want to focus on the boys in the band. That's another area that I want to investigate, specifically because they have a Broadway revival coming for that. And I think it's timely with some really great names attached to it. But aside from that, I'm just, like I said, I've been collecting stories and trying to get through as much of that, serving that content up as people are requesting it as much as possible.
Excellent. And I can't wait for the boys in the band one. That one, I think, absolutely, I'm fascinated to see what your take on that will be. That'll be
yeah.
great. Anyway, I want to thank you for coming
political.
On. Yeah, exactly. No, totally. And we are out of time. So I want to thank you definitely for coming on. Brad, it has been an honor. I want to thank Brody and Don for your expertise and your participation and everything you do. It's been fantastic. And I want to thank our listeners for listening. Also listen to Out in Santa Cruz Saturday on www.ksco.com, also 7 p.m. Pacific Time, 10 p.m. Eastern. You've been listening to LGBTQ Rated LGBT Radio, and we will see you again, hear you again, talk to you again next week.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio!